fascinating subject in Torah that one thinks of at this time. The Gemara in Sukkah, that's the subject of idolatry. Avodah Zorah, idolatry. What is this thing of worshipping idols? How does it relate to our desire to do this kind of thing today? Do we have a desire? Don't we have a desire? How does it relate to other religions? Do we consider them to be idolatrous or don't we? What is the concept of astrology? Is that fit into this category or doesn't it? Is it idolatrous? What's the problem with it? These are all very fascinating questions, many of which are specifically relevant to us. The Gemara in Sukkah, why am I thinking about it now? The Gemara says the following thing. In the fifth chapter, the last chapter of the Gemara that deals with the laws of Sukkahs, it describes the celebration that took place in the Beis HaMikdash at this time of year. During Sukkahs, it says that they used to go into the temple, and there's the lady's son. It says that the people in Jerusalem used to go into the temple, and they used to do a very elaborate celebration. A fantastic description of the celebration. It says there were lights that lit up every home in Jerusalem from the Temple Mount. There were oil lamps, but so powerful that a woman in a home could sort wheat grains, it says, all over Jerusalem. Amazing light and tricks that people used to do. The most saintly of the sages used to do amazing acrobatic feats and juggling feats. A very time of amazing celebration, happiness. But part of the celebration was a very strange thing. It says, this requires understanding. It says that at this time of celebration, and you must understand that the happiness, the celebration, is the happiness of Emunah. Not just a celebration of because the time of year happens to be happy, or because as the uninformed think it's the harvest time. Sukkot is the harvest time, so like it's agriculturally happy. I'm trying to understand here the spiritual core. So the celebration here, the happiness, is the mystics describe the pathway of coming through Yom Kippur, which means through a time of judgment. It means Rosh Hashanah is the time when you work on yourself. Yom Kippur is the test, the testing grounds of whether you made it or not. You get judged very critically. Every aspect of your being is judged on Yom Kippur. And then, as soon as you get through the judgment and is finalized what will be with a person for the next year, so then a person consolidates that situation. That means we understand we've been forgiven. We use Yom Kippur to achieve a state of purity or forgiveness. And then from there, when a person has that level of purity, a person needs to move into a place of protection. That level of protection is called a sukkah. You have in Torah many examples of people who went through ordeals, or the Jewish people who went through ordeals. You see, the next step the Torah always describes is called a sukkah. It says, by Yaakov, when he met Esav, Jacob, and Esau, after he survived the ordeal of meeting his brother, he moved into a sukkah. It says, by the Jewish people, when they went through the Red Sea, the next thing they did was they went to a place called Sukkot, sukkahs. In other words, we understand that after an ordeal comes the consolidation or the protection of what's called a sukkah. Sukkah means Hashem's protection. I mean, we do it physically, tangibly in the world by building a sukkah. But spiritually, mystically, it means moving into a place of protection. And the happiness of that is that a person can feel that he's inside the protection of Hashem's Hashgacha. That's the lady side. Can't see if you're a lady from here, right? I haven't got my glasses. I'm being fussy about it because in the same Gemara, it says that when they went into the Beis HaMikdash, they had a very special arrangement that men and women sat separate. When it was a time of happiness, and people might be lightheaded, that means there was a time of relaxed emotions, not the tension of Yom Kippur, they made a special arrangement that men and women should sit separate. That's what it says. The men, it says, the women used to sit in front, the men used to sit at the back. Then it says people still weren't perfect. So they put the women at the back and the men in front. And it says still wasn't perfect, so they put the women upstairs. That's what it says in the Beis HaMikdash. Special place where women sat. They put them upstairs so they didn't bother the men. So it says, people of that generation who are close to perfection. Bother the men, I mean, because men are subject to being distracted in this area. And in that generation of perfectionists are concerned, can you imagine us in our shattered state, the degree of protection that we need? Okay, now, this concept of protection or consolidation of a spiritual state is what's called a sukkah. That's what's called a sukkah. There's a lot of depth to why it is there, perhaps some other time we can talk about it. But the emunah, that means the happiness, the consolidation, the feeling that a person can have is feeling close to Hashem. Why that happens in a sukkah is a fascinating discussion, but not for now. And that's why the sukkah in the mystical writings is called Sela Demehem Nusa, the shade of Emunah, the shadow of Emunah. It's the protection that overshadows a person, which is that protection of the closeness of being, of having knowledge of Hashem, which is what we call Emunah. Now, in that celebration of this emotion of Emunah, and of course you're beginning up, I'm sure you're racing ahead of me, and you're already beginning to feel that the concept of Emunah, which means the way we relate to Hashem, the closeness that we feel to Hashem, is exactly the opposite of idolatry. Idolatry means a person's extension, when he wants to extend himself, into an area where he connects to something that's beyond and above him, but it's not the correct source. What's called Avodah Zara. That means strange worship or work that a person does towards the center of being, that's, in other words, that he feels is transcendent and above him, but it's not the correct source. A person can either focus his energy that connects with a higher power, he can focus it correctly towards Hashem, or he can focus it incorrectly to transcendent power that is real and outside of him, but not the correct source. That's why it's called strange worship, or foreign worship, let's say. Now, obviously the time that is going to be the time when a person can connect with a correct source is obviously going to be the time when the danger exists of connecting with a wrong source. We'll try and understand this more deeply. The spiritual rule is always that you have equal and opposite forces in the spiritual world. You never have two different things. You always have one thing, but can be applied in two different ways. That's the spiritual rule. The rule is that there's nothing, for example, in the world that's good or bad. There's only things in the world that are more powerful or less powerful. What you use them for could be equally used in the good side of the bad. Person happens to be, let's say, influential. So he could use it to influence people correctly for spiritual positivity. He could use it to harm people. Or a person's wealthy, let's say. Wealth. Wealth isn't good or bad. The more wealth a person has, the more he can use it in the positive direction, the more harm he could do with it. Or let's say power. Let's say nuclear power. Nuclear power is much more power than, let's say, conventional electric power. So you could do much more good with it and much more destruction. You see, the thing itself is not good or bad, it just depends how it's channeled. If there's a power in the human neshama that wants to extend the human being to something beyond himself, so then it could be that he can connect with the correct source, but with equal energy could connect with the wrong source. The time of year that a person could feel emunah, this could be a time when a person could connect with the wrong source. Now, with those ideas as background, let's see how the Gemara puts it. So the Mishnah says the following thing, amazing thing, frightening thing. The Mishnah says that during the celebration, they used to have a procession where the Kohanim, they used to go up the stairs. There were 15 steps. The Shir HaMaalot, the 15 psalms that are said in Tehillim, actually go according to those 15 levels of spiritual elevation. The Kohanim used to go up the stairs and they used to move towards the Kodesh Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies at the center of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash. When they got there, to a certain point, and they used to blow trumpets on the way, blow in different ways, blow a trumpet this way, that way. Very elaborate discussion at the Mishnah, lengthy Mishnah. But at the end, the Mishnah says the following thing. When they got to the sanctum, the Holy of Holies, let's say they walked this way towards the Kodesh Kodoshim, when they got to the curtain, or when they got to a certain point, they turned around and they said the following thing. They declared as follows. Our forefathers who stood in this place were idolaters. That's what they say. Our forefathers, they stood in this place, and they were involved in Avodah Zarah, in idolatrous worship. But the way the Mishnah puts it is they say like this. They say, our forefathers stood in this place. The Mishnah says like this. Pneim el Hashemesh, they faced the sun, v'achoreim el Hechal, and they turned their backs to the sanctum, to the Kodesh Kodoshim, to the Holy of Holies. That's what it says. What does it mean? Simply, it means this, that they worship the sun. Instead of facing the direction of where the Holy of Holy was, the Kodesh Kodoshim, they faced the sun. That means they worship the force of nature. That's idolatry. That's what it is. They worship something idolatrous. And of course, they turned their backs on the real source of Kedusha, Hashem's manifestation in the world, which is the center of the temple of Beis HaMikdash, where the Shekhinah, Hashem's presence, manifested itself. So the commentaries say the following thing. So let's first of all, I'll tell you what the Mishnah says, then we'll try and understand it in depth. We can, we'll try and bring a little of the mystical insights here, see if we can understand. Our forefathers stood at this place, they were idolatrous, and therefore they faced the east, they faced the sun, and their backs were to the Holy of Holies, that's what it says, but we, this is what the Mishnah says, aval einenu l'ka, our eyes are to Hashem, the name Yud and the Hey, you know, Hashem's name Yes, the four-lettered name of Hashem starts with a Yud and a Hey, and that's also one of the names of Hashem. Actually, the commentaries point out that it equals 15. Very interesting. It's also 15. Represents the 15th level. But be that as it may, the Yud and the Hey is the name of Hashem. We don't actually even pronounce that name. That's how we pronounce it. We pronounce it in an unusual way. We, instead of saying the sound of a Yud and a Hey, we say Ka, let's say. But whatever you want to say for that name. So they said this. Let's get the statement correct. That our ancestors stood here. They worshipped the sun. They turned their backs to Hashem. But they turned their eyes towards the sun. We turn our eyes towards Hashem. Then the Mishnah records that there's an argument. Rabbi Yehuda, one of the great Tanoim of that generation, comes along and he argues. And he says, no, you shouldn't say that. You shouldn't say our eyes are towards Hashem. You should say, Aval anu leka, we are for Hashem, uleka enenu. And to Hashem our eyes are turned. And it's very hard to understand that argument. What exactly are they arguing about? Are you with me? Yeah, zombie death from Yontef, right? You're vaguely with me still. The argument is difficult to understand. It sounds like a subtlety that's hard to grasp. The Chachamim say that what we say is that our eyes are turned towards Hashem. And if Yehuda comes and argues and says, no, we must say that we are towards Hashem and our eyes are turned towards Him. What exactly is the difference? Let's try and understand this issue of idolatry, and perhaps we'll be able to answer this question at the end. Let's try and understand. First of all, let me share with you an insight into this Mishnah, which is an amazing, amazing thing. The first thing to note about this Mishnah is this. The Marashor, Rashi actually mentions it himself, he says the following thing. Why does the Mishnah, as I'm sure you're aware, I'm sure everybody has got enough knowledge, background in Torah to know that a Mishnah has no extra words. The Mishnah never gives you information that it doesn't have to give you. So the commentaries ask the following question. Why does the Mishnah have to say that they turned their faces towards the sun and they turned their backs towards the holy place? Obviously, if they were standing there and their faces were towards the sun, we know how the Beis HaMikdash was situated, orientated. We know the east was where the sun shone from. And we know that the westernmost part was the Kodesh Kodashim. So obviously, if they faced the sun, their backs were to the Kodesh Kodashim. Why does the Mishnah have to state it? You hear the question. They stood in this position, they turned their faces towards the sun, and they turned their backs towards, you know, you only have one front and one back. If you turn your front towards the sun and you're standing there, your back is automatically to the Kodesh Kodashim. Are you with me? So why does the Mishnah have to say it? What extra piece of information is being conveyed in the fact that their back was turned? Come the commentaries and say the following thing. It means that they revealed themselves, they uncovered their nakedness, and they performed their ablutions. You hear this? They performed their physical needs, their bodily functions, in that holy place. That's what they did. You follow? They used it as a bathroom. You follow? Amazing thing, that. What's that got to do with idolatrous worship? You hear the question? That's what it says they did. What does it mean, their backs? It means literally. That literally it means. Not just to tell you the way they were facing. We know that already from where their faces were facing. No, it means that they... Amazing thing. What does this mean, exactly? What's this got to do with idolatry? What kind of uncouth behavior... In case you think it's some kind of aberrant, you know, these were psychotic individuals who had been brought up, you know, they'd been smacked in the wrong place when they were three by their mothers a little too harshly, so they, you know, grew up with psychological imbalance. In case you think that, obviously it's not, because you see in Chumash that the epitome, the height of idolatrous worship was exactly that. I'm sure you remember that the worship of Baal Peor, in Chumash it says that the height of idolatrous worship, I don't understand this very difficult concept, that the Jews went through the desert, and they came across a people, the people of Midian, who were involved in this practice of idolatry. They worshipped an idol, and the form of worship of the idol was exactly that. You went up to the idol, and the way you paid homage, the way you did your idolatrous act over there was you proceeded to ablute in the most disgusting fashion. That's what you did. The Gemara records... Fascinating thing that there was a woman who was involved in idolatry, a certain woman, she was Jewish, I'm not sure. She was involved in idolatry and she tried all of them. She'd been all over the world and she'd done every idolatrous practice that there was. She'd worshipped every form of idolatry in the world. When she heard about this, she thought it was so disgusting. She'd done everything in the world, you can imagine. She'd been to all the crazy innovations that these idolatrous twisted people, and often the Gemara says clearly that idolatry is only a means for licentiousness. It means it's only an opportunity. You only choose yourself a God other than the real one to permit you to do what you want to do, to get involved in sensuality. So you can imagine what she'd been involved in. But she heard that there was this particular Buddhism. When she heard about that, she found it so disgusting that she decided to show what she thought about it. So she went up to this idol and she proceeded to perform her bodily functions on top of the idol. So it says the priests of that idol, they came up to her and they shook her hand in admiration. They said, Shekhar, they've never seen anybody worship in such a consummate way, with such incredible perception of what this thing was. Do you follow? It's an amazing thing. They've never seen anybody who grasped exactly what this worship was in such a consummate way. So it requires explanation, this. Fortunately, you see that the drive to idolatry has been taken out of our minds. We don't have an urge to do this kind of thing. We don't have the urge to bow down to a piece of wood or some kind of graven image. I mean, I'm not saying that we're any less disgusting in this generation. Probably a lot more. But we certainly don't have the natural desire to worship some sort of figure or some sort of pictorial or graphic image. We don't have that. The Gemara says it was eradicated from human consciousness by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. If we get time, we'll talk about that also. But let's understand what it is, and let's understand in terms of astrology and various other things where its application is in the world today. Then perhaps we'll try and understand what it has to do with the Sukkah, with the Mishnah we began with. Let's take a trip together now for the next few minutes, and we'll explore the field. Let's explore together the subject. What is this idea of Avodah Zarah? What is this concept of idolatry? It's a fascinating thing. It comes up again and again in Torah. What does it mean exactly? What is this desire that a human being has to worship something other than the source of existence? What does it mean exactly? What's its perversion? Where does it come from? How does it end up in such disgusting behavior? What's the connection? Let's try and understand. Let me first give you a mystical, the way the mystics describe it, okay? We can't really understand these words, but it gives us a framework. You know that when you talk in mystical language, it's forbidden to actually picture things in the way that the word suggests. Everyone has to be very careful. I'm going to give you now a picture that the mystics use to describe this thing. One is not allowed to believe it. In other words, one's only allowed to understand that the words are just enough of a framework to begin to understand the subject, but not to really picture it that way. Are you with me? The person has to be very careful with this. So they say something like this. There is a system of reality. That means, if you want to examine how reality manifests itself, so you have what we call Hashem, God, the source of existence. He gives energy, or gives existence, to various levels of reality that are below Him. We're not going to go into what this all means now. I'm just giving you a picture, whether we can understand it or not, that's the picture. He has a level of reality that's below Him, less real, obviously, because He's the ultimate definition of reality, but more tangible in physical terms. That level then gives existence or energy to the one below it, and so forth in an infinite chain. Okay, the final level of reality is this level here. There's another level outside which is called the shells. I'm not going to go into that now. Maybe some other time after midnight. For now, the bottom level of reality is this, the physical world. This derives its energy from the level above it, and that from the level above it, and so forth and so on. What are these levels? Certain of these levels are called angels, whatever that means, different levels of angels. The Rambam goes through a discussion of 10 different levels of angels. Each one knows the one above it, but not the one above that, and so forth. But let it be enough for us now to understand just this idea, that there's a source of existence that energizes or gives existence to the one below it, and that to the one below that, and so forth and so on. Each one more tangible or more concrete than the one before, until finally you get to this level which is manifest as the physical world. Now, are you with me so far? Now, the critical difference, for us to understand the difference between each level and the one above it is almost impossible. Although there's a lot written about it in the mystical writings. But the difference between this level and the one above it we can grasp. Okay, that's what we want to focus on. This physical world and the one above it, whatever that may be, it has a name, but whatever it is, the difference is this, that this is the only level that's finite. In other words, that's physical. Finite and limited in this sense. Okay? Where an object has only one set of definitions. You follow? An object in this world is this object, and it's not two things, it's only one thing. In a higher level, when you get things which are called angels, they multi-potential. You follow? It could be more than one thing. They can manifest in different ways. But this chair only manifests as this chair. Are you with me? In other words, the finite world that we exist in, I don't want to use the finite because there are levels above it that are finite also, but the physical level of the world that we exist in is fixed and frozen in position. None of the worlds above it are like that. They're all spiritual worlds, greater or lesser degree. Now, so far that's not difficult, right? You with me? So far I can grasp that, right? Now, this is the critical point to understand. In the mystical writings, the Shamish Shmuel makes it very, very clear. He says this, that whenever you have two levels, you must have an intermediate level that joins them. Okay? There must be a level that joins them. Yeah. I'm not going to go into proofs why that is. Maral talks about it also. Which means this, if you've got spiritual worlds and you've got a physical world, there must be a special world that joins the two of them. Because if the energy flows from the one to the other, there must be a channel. There must be some point of connection. Okay? You follow? There must be a way in which the higher world plugs into the lower world and transmits its energy. That place where the two worlds meet is called the world of Mazalos. In English, it's called the astrological world. It's called the world of astrology. Let's understand. The Hebrew word for it is mazal. The perverted translation in English means luck. Right? Mazal means luck. It's exactly the opposite. Because mazal means, you know, you're either lucky or you're not. Mazal in English connotes, you know, when you translate it, the concept we have is exactly the opposite of Ashkocha. It means, you know, it's your luck, whether it happens this way or doesn't happen that way. We, first of all, we don't have such a concept in Torah. There's no such thing that things happen accidentally. And on the contrary, that very word is exactly the place where Hashem's Rotson, Hashem's desire, what he wants, is manifest in this world, not happenstance or coincidence. It's exactly the opposite. That's called the word mazal. Let's just analyze the word for a second. The root of the Hebrew word mazal, anyone who knows any Hebrew knows that the root is nozel, which means to flow down. A liquid in Hebrew is nozel. It flows, it leaks or drips or flows. That's mazal. That's nozel, which means it's the place where the higher worlds flow down into manifestation in this world. You follow? That's called the world of the stars. Why it's the stars, I'm not going to go into now. The stars are connected, by the way. We're not talking about the stars in the sky. Those happen to be a gauge. Somebody who knows how to read that, those constellations can connect into this world of Mazal, of Mazalos, what we call the zodiac, right? But let's not limit ourselves now to understanding that it's the way this planet is or the way that planet. We're not talking about that. Or those deeply connected. If we get time, we'll try and explain it also. What we're talking about right now is that there's a world which connects the world that's beyond the stars, which is outside of the physical universe, that's not manifest in any type of physical dimension, and it connects that world with the world that is entirely finite and physical, and that we can experience. That intermediate world is called the astrological world. Are you with me? So the mystics describe it as if it was a pipeline, a series of pipelines. Yes? Let's try and make the picture final like this. There's the beginning of the pipelines, right, where the energy starts. We can't perceive that level. It's too far above us. The energy flows down through certain pipelines, and the pipelines end. There's a mouth of the pipe, which opens up, and out of that pipeline pours out the influence that I feel, that affects my life, okay? I'm born under certain constellation of pipelines, let's call it, one of the mystics called sinoires, tubes or pipes. So then I'm born with a certain kind of personality. That's what it says. The Gemara says that. Not an impure belief. It's a Jewish belief. It was said a child can be born with a personality entirely conditioned by the day on which he's born. Definitely. I was once with a great mystic in Jerusalem. He looked at me very strangely. He said to me, "When's your birthday?" And I said to him, "Today." That was our conversation. Anyway. Now, these pipelines, right, the way they operate is like this. The way they set up is the way the energy flows out. If the pipe is thicker or narrower or orientated this way or that way, let's use a crude analogy, then the energy flows out to me. But when I look up, I can't see the root of the pipeline. All I see is the opening. You follow me? I can't see where it comes from, but I can see where the energy pours out. In other words, I can see me and I can see what's happening to me. If I trace the source of what's happening to me, I can look up and I can see that it's coming down to me from a certain place. Beyond that, I can't see. Okay? The highest I can see, if I know how to look, then I'm looking at a place that's called the astrological world. You see, people make a mistake. They think that astrologers can see the future. It's a very bad mistake. Nobody can see the future. Only a Navi, a prophet, can know something about the future, and we don't have prophets anymore, but we do have astrologers. Not most of them who advertise as astrologers, by the way. Most are hoaxers and people who are taking money and wielding influence. But it is possible, but there are people who certainly can do this. And certainly in times gone by, there have been people who are very powerful in this area. People who are astrologers are not reading the future, they're reading the present. They're seeing the way the energy, you follow me, they're not reading the future. Nobody can tell you the future. He's reading the present. Only that element that he's reading in the present hasn't manifested yet, so you don't see it. If you would want a crude analogy, are you beginning to get the picture a little bit? If you would want a crude analogy, it would be something like this. Let's say you have a woman who's pregnant. Now, you ask me a question, what is the child going to look like when he's big? What color eyes, what color hair, and so forth and so on. I couldn't tell you, can't see. But you give me a few cells from the fluid that surrounds the child, and I can analyze it genetically. I can tell you, if you know how, what color hair he's going to have, and with biochemistry, and what color eyes, and so forth and so on. I'm not telling the future. You'd think somebody who doesn't know how this all works would think that this man is reading the future. Not reading the future, he's reading the present. The clues, in other words, the genetic, you follow me? If you could see the conception of a child and catch the genes as they're being laid down, so you'd be able to see what this child is going to look like. You're not reading the future, you're reading the present. You're seeing how the thing is being put together in the stages, like a man who knows how to read the architect's plans. He can picture the building. He's not predicting what the future is going to be. You follow? Of course, in a sense, he is. He's saying it before it happens. But only by the skill that he has in reading the present. Astrology is like that. Astrology looks at the source of where the energy comes from and can tell you that because the energies are set up in this and this way, then more or less, by the way, it can never be accurate. It can never be accurate. It's a special limitation. But more or less, this and this and this is going to happen. That's what an astrologer can tell you. Not reading the future, but he knows with more skill than you do how to read what's happening now. Now, with that background, let's try and understand. That's the mystical conception. Let's try and make it more practical now. Bring it down to the Musa level, the emotional level. Try and understand. When a person's involved in astrology, what he's doing is he's looking at the root. He's not looking at the real source of existence. He's looking at the level that manifests tangibly on him. Now, let's try and keep that in mind, and let's try and explore the area. You see, that comes from the mystical writings. I once spoke to a man, the great Rosh Yeshiva, who will never admit to any Kabbalistic knowledge. And whenever I ask him about anything Kabbalistic, he says he doesn't know anything about it. And then he proceeds to explain the thing on his purely human terms, without any Kabbalistic reference, but of course he's talking exactly, he just doesn't want to admit that he knows anything about it, and he puts it in simple terms that a child could understand. So now I'll tell you the way he put it, and you'll see it's a fantastic understanding of the subject, and you'll see how it connects with the mystical level that we spoke about before. He said to me once the following thing. What exactly is Avodah Zarah? What is idolatry? What is this power of people worshipping graven image? What does it mean? Now, let's understand. The first thing you have to know is this, that it's very real. It's very real. It's not a figment of someone's imagination. It's very real. And I'll give you two proofs. First, let's know what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with idiots. The Torah doesn't waste its time dealing with fools. There's a principle in Torah that we're not speaking to the evil-minded, the Rishoyim, and to the fools, the Shoitim. Because you can't influence those two. A man who's willfully evil, there's no amount of proof that you can bring him if he wants to be evil. And an absolute idiot who's got no intelligence at all, you can't reason with. So the Torah just can't concern itself with those two groups of people. So if you're talking about an absolute fool who carves an image out of a piece of wood and says it's his God, the Torah doesn't have to waste time with a prohibition against idiocy. Do you follow? The Torah doesn't waste its time prohibiting what's foolish. You follow me? It's forbidden, but the Torah... I'll tell you what happened once in Yeshiva University. Once in Yeshiva University, they once started judah. They had judah. One of the sports they had there was judah. But you know, before you fight the other man in judah, you have to bow down to him. That's a shalom halacha, you know, you're not allowed to bow to anything other than Hashem. So the people who started the judah group, they went to Rav Soloveitchik, the Rosh Yeshiva, and they said to him, listen, we're starting this judah thing, but you know, you've got to bow down to each other before you fight. Is it allowed? So he said, no, it's forbidden. So they said to him, where does it say it's forbidden? Why is it forbidden? He said, because it's silly. And anything that's silly is forbidden, like Torah. So he said, I don't understand. Anyway, so let's understand. Now, the Torah comes with prohibition against this idolatry, and there's almost nothing in the Torah strong. It's one of the three cardinal sins that you have to give your life for. The Torah wouldn't be so explicit about it and make such strong prohibitions about it if it was just silly nonsense. You follow me? The Torah doesn't come along with a whole list of prohibitions of all the kind of psychotic imaginations a person might have. There's no end to it. So why does it pick on this one if it's foolishness and non-existence? Secondly, the Torah says that anything that's connected with idolatry, you're not allowed to get any benefit from at all. If some fool worships some graven image someplace, and he uses a broom to sweep the floor of that place, you're not allowed to get benefit from the broom. Do you know that? You follow me? If there's a shrine someplace in some part of the world where they bow down to some image, and they use a broom to clean the floor of that place, I can't use that broom for firewood, because it's so contaminated by this power. And that doesn't sound like some, you follow, if some psychotic individual had some fantasy figment of his imagination, would I be forbidden from using anything that was connected to that thing? It's nonsense. You get my point. The Torah doesn't come along and prohibit nonsense. Nonsense is nonsense. You don't need to tell me something that, first of all. Second of all, you find, and you begin to feel here, that sounds like there's something very powerful in this thing. It doesn't sound like nonsense. If the Torah is so concerned about it as being a cardinal sin that you have to give your life for, it sounds like it's something very real and dangerous, not a figment of the imagination. First of all. Secondly, there's plenty of places in Torah, verses that actually speak about gods other than Hashem, as if they really exist. Right? Atagibo ba'elim Hashem, it says. Hashem, you are great among all the gods. That's what it says. You, Hashem, are great among all the gods. That's what it says. What gods? I thought they were a figment of the imagination. What's the Pasuk telling you that Hashem is great among all the gods, if all these gods are figments of the imagination? The Pasuk is very misleading. You follow me? There's plenty of verses like that. It says, Ki kol Elohei ha'amim elilim, v'Hashem shamayim asa. All the gods of the nations are weak or sort of ineffectual little gods, and Hashem made the heaven and earth, made the heavens. So the Torah actually said that there are gods, alright, they're inferior to Hashem, they're weak, and they're little, and whatever you want to say, but the Torah says they exist. I mean, the verse actually says so, and there are dozens and dozens of verses that refer to other gods. Elohim Acherim, it talks about other gods, it says Elohim Acherim. It says Elohim Acherim, other gods. That you wouldn't speak that way about something that doesn't exist. You're fooling me into thinking that they do. Can you follow? Are you with me? You grasp the problem. Alright, it's true that the mystics say that when it says Elohim Acherim, the word Acherim, meaning others, also means Acharayim, which means the back side. You follow? Because other gods represent the back face. The real reality in the world is the face. The dark side of the human form is the back. And that's why it's blind, and it's dumb, and that's excretion takes place. It's all the negativity of the humans expressed in the back. And of course, that's why it says Adam and Eve were created without a back. You know that? It says they were fused, their backs were fused. Do you know that? When Adam and Chava were born, were created in the world, they were a fused being. He faced one way, and she faced the other, and there was no back. Because they were on such a spiritual level, there was only face. There was the face of a man, there was the face of a woman, but there was no back. The mystics explain that when two people are fused back to back, it means that they're protecting each other's weak side. The possibility of weakness and fall spiritually is not exposed. You follow? When two people are caught in a corner by a group of thugs, so what they do, people who trained in this, they stand back to back because it's the only way you can protect each other's blind. Do you follow? So man and woman created in such a way that there was no exposed negativity. Wonderful idea. So other gods is always back gods. It means gods of the back face of reality. And that's why idolatry is always expressed. Now we begin to understand a little bit. Remember we started with this discussion of this disgusting form of worship? Idolatry is always connected to that. That's why it's called many times Gilulim. Gilulim, yes, Avodas Gilulim, means the worship of, Gilulim means Avodah Zorah. But you know what the word literally means? Balls of dung, that's what it means. Gilulim means dung balls. Excrement, that's what it means. That means the way the Torah describes idolatrous worship is the worship of excretion. That's what it talks about. There's a pasuk that says that when the Mashiach comes, Hashem says, Ani esbol va'amalek. I will bear this, and in laughter I will, I'm afraid to say the word in English, I will spit out, but in a much more crude way. I will distinguish between what's good and between what's waste. The front side of the person is what assimilates and ingests that which gives life, and the backside of a person is that which excretes waste product. That's what it is. Idolatry is taking the bad part of the food. You follow? It's not taking the part that sustains. The work of being human is to take food which is a mixture. You then extract what sustains life, and you excrete the waste. Idolatry is latching onto the waste product. But not something that's not real. It is real. Just it's the waste of reality. It's the back of reality. Just try and understand. Is anybody with me at all? Don't blame me. Let's try and understand. The Gemara says that they are founder of a certain spiritual system. I don't want to go into detail, this is being recorded. Certain spiritual system in the world, the founder of that system is being boiled in the next world in boiling excrement. That's what it says. That's his punishment. He started a system that involves certain idolatrous practices, this man. What's his punishment? In the next world he's being boiled in boiling excrement. That's what the Gemara says. Why such a punishment? It's a strange punishment that. That's exactly what he did. He brought to the world that people, instead of latching onto reality, they should latch onto that part which is specifically to be excreted, to be rejected. The world is a mixture of good and bad, of reality and non-reality, of illusion and reality. You're supposed to sort out and sift through the world and latch onto reality.
and excrete and distinguish from the non-reality. But idolatry in the world latches on to that which should be, you follow, exactly the opposite. Let's try and see if we can understand. Let's try and understand it this way. This great man whom I mentioned to you once put it to me in the following way. He said to me once, you know what idolatry is? For those of you not mystically minded, let's try and, I promise to make it more tangible, okay? Let's see if you can, see if we can stay together. He said like this, you know what idolatry is? He said idolatry is the following thing. Excuse me, before I tell you his analogy, let me tell you the way the Rambam puts it, okay? It makes it clearer. The Rambam says, how did idolatry begin in the world? It's a fascinating question. You know, the world began with the consciousness of Hashem. God created man and woman, they spoke to Hashem directly. Adam handed down the tradition of the spiritual wisdom to Noah, to Noah. He gave it to his sons. They all knew the spiritual wisdom. So where did the idolatrous idea creep into the world? Where did it begin? So the Rambam says it began like this. A fantastic thing to understand. The Rambam says this is what happened. In the early generations of the earth's history, people said to themselves the following thing. They said, we perceive that there is in the world a thing called Hashem, we know about that, but we also see that He manifests His power in the world through certain intermediaries. Listen carefully. Hashem doesn't relate to me directly. When something happens to me in the world, do I see Hashem doing it? No. What do I see? I see a force of nature. I see a law of physics, or a force of nature. Is that correct? When a person, chas v'shalom, gets ill, he doesn't see the hand of God, he sees the physical illness. Or when a person has good fortune in the world, his crops grow and his fields are fruitful. He doesn't see Hashem operating, he sees the rain and the laws of nature, the sun and the rain. So they said the following thing. It means that Hashem is the cause of reality, but the way He manifests the reality and He impinges it on me is through the forces of nature. Are you beginning to connect this with the pipelines that we discussed before? Therefore, they said, this is what the Rambam says, they said to themselves, well, it makes sense to honor His agencies as you would honor Him. They reasoned as follows. The Rambam says, if a king comes to visit you in your house, you give him great honor. But what if the king doesn't come to visit you, sends you his prime minister, a respected head of his cabinet, right, of his government. He sends to your house. Wouldn't you honor him? Of course you'd honor him. And in honoring him, you'd be honoring the king because he's an emissary of the king. So the sun and the moon and the forces of nature, says the Rambam, they are Hashem's way of dealing with the world. So isn't it fitting to show them honor? The sun is an incredible source of life on earth. So isn't it fitting to show honor to the sun? You follow? Not divorced from Hashem. Of course it's only controlled. It's only an inanimate object that Hashem is controlling. But since Hashem saw fit to deal with me through that great, enormous power in the world, so I'll honor it and relate to it as a manifestation of Hashem. Said the Rambam. So they started doing that. They started worshipping Hashem and they started worshipping the intermediaries. And then, says the Rambam, they forgot about Hashem. They forgot about the source and they were left with worshipping intermediaries. And that's how Avodah Zorah began. That's idolatry. That's what he says. Now let's try and understand this more deeply. This needs a lot of explanation. What they forgot? They forgot about the source of reality? How did that happen? So this Rosh Yeshiva said to me the following thing. He put it this way, he said like this. You know what, these are virtually his words. He said to me, you know what idolatry is? You know what Avodah Zarah? He said it's the following thing. So a man walks into a department store. This is the way he said it. A man walks into a department store and he goes to the camera department. And there behind the counter he sees a video camera. This is the example he gave me. The video camera costs $1,500. The man doesn't have $1,500. He got only $150. So what does he do? He calls the clerk behind the counter. He says to him, listen, I'll slip you $150. Give me the camera. You follow? What's going on here? This man, he wants the goods. He wants the camera. Right? He doesn't care who owns the shop. He doesn't care who's responsible, who's being cheated over here. He doesn't care who runs the overall department store. All he's interested is the man who can deliver the goods. There's a man behind the counter here, right? He can get that camera for me. If I pay him off a certain amount, a cheap amount, he can deliver the goods. You hear the analogy? Said Rav Wasserman the following thing. That's what idolatry is. Idolatry is a man, he doesn't care who's the overall boss. Not interested in that. He's interested in who can deliver him the goods. You follow? The son, let's say a man who's involved in idolatry, he's interested in a power that's a god of love, fertility, war, peace, prosperity, whatever it is. Why? Because those are the goods that he wants. Who runs the overall thing? It doesn't interest him. You follow me? It's irrelevant. What do I care about him? So somebody runs the show. and somebody's being cheated at the end of the story, at the end of the day. But I'm interested in the good. In other words, if you really understand carefully, what he means is, I'm interested in me. That's what he means. The man is interested in who can deliver me the goods. What he means is, I care about me. The man who cares about Hashem, I'll do anything for him. The man is interested in the agencies, the departments of the department store. He's interested in him. Thank you. If you think about it, you'll see, if you think about Greek mythology, the Greeks had a lot of gods. The Greeks had a lot of gods, a whole array of them up on Mount whatever it is over there. You follow, conducting lots of immoral business between them over there. That's what the Greeks believe. The Greeks was a very immoral society. It was a tremendously hedonistic, pleasure-filled society. It was a society that was very, you follow, the focus was on the pleasure of the body, and it was a society that had many gods. But the unique thing about the Greek gods is, if you go through the whole pantheon of Greek gods, you won't find one who created the world. Isn't that remarkable? There's a god of love, and a god of war, and a god, oh, you name it, there's a god of it. But one who created the world up there? I don't have one of them. Because it's irrelevant. You follow? What goods does he deliver? He did his job already, so forget about him. Do you follow the concept? There's a god of war because, boy, I need him. There's a god of love and fertility and so forth and so on because I need those departments. But the one who created the overall thing in the beginning, I'm not interested in him. So, of course, it was a society. The real focus in society wasn't on worship of the gods. It was on worship of me. But I'll cook up a whole system of them in the departments that I need. And of course, I'm prepared to pay them off. I'm not prepared to pay the real price. The real price is me. The real price is all you have. Religion, worship of Hashem, Avodas Hashem means giving everything. Absolutely everything. Every second of your life from now until you die. And afterwards also. Every single fiber of your being. Every single second of your life. That's the price. That's what it costs. No less than that. That's the cost. That's the cost of worshipping Hashem. That's what it means. You follow. If you're interested in you, you're not prepared to pay that price. You'll pay a little bit here and there. You'll cut yourself and you'll go through pain and stuff. You'll do a lot, you follow, to get delivered the goods in the departments that you want. But you're not going to give everything. Can you hear what's going on here? Now, let's try and understand this more deeply. So the concept of idolatry. So now let's go back to the Rambam. The Rambam says that they started worshipping the sun and they forgot about Hashem. They didn't forget about Hashem. It suited them to forget about Hashem. The reason that they started worshipping the intermediaries, the vested interest they had, the rationale they gave was, well, it's an emissary of Hashem, so we should show it honor. But the real hidden motivation was, they're more important to me than he is. Because from him, I don't get, from him I give. That was the way they saw it. He demands from me, I've got to live my life the way he wants. But the departments, the sun and the moon and the agencies of nature and so forth and so on, they give. Through them flows the energy that I need. That's what I'm really interested in. So they put up with both. At the end of the day, they forgot about the source. Not they forgot. That's exactly what the point of the exercise was. They forgot about the source and they started dealing with the intermediaries because that's where the goods come from. Are you with me? Do you follow this? Now, And again, I'm afraid to be too specific over here, but if you, I'll just say it in the form of a hint. If you look in systems other than Torah in the world, you'll see that the pathway is always the opposite. In Torah, you'll see the pathway is sacrifice of the human for Hashem. In other systems, you'll see that it's Hashem doing the sacrifice for us. I need to be more explicit. Huh? If you look at them, you'll see. In all systems. Not only that, but you'll see a remarkable thing. You'll see that the object of worship is a power in nature, but it's represented as a human form. If you go into the study of idolatry, of cultures that are idolatrous, that worship graven images and forms, you'll see that very often the form of what's worshipped has a human structure. It's an image or a carving or a statue or representation of the human. Actually, it's not representing a human. They're not worshipping a man. They're not worshipping a human. If you go to the South Sea Islands where they've got these figures carved, or when you go to cultures where they have a graven image or a pictorial image of a man, they're not worshipping a man. They're worshipping a power in nature. Why is it depicted as human? You have to understand this. The idea is this. It's depicted as something graphic because these people are shrinking reality down to something that can be grasped, that's tangible. You see, the sun, or force in nature, is already too intangible, and therefore they wish to represent it. You follow? You must never make the mistake of thinking that this idiot is worshipping a picture on a piece of wood. We're not dealing with fools, like I said before. You follow? He's made the picture on a piece of wood to represent. It's a representation, you follow, of the power that he's relating to, but he's relating to a real power. A real power that does exist in the world. Why did he depict the power in human form? Because really, that's what he's interested in, is him. It's actually a picture of him that's going on. Again, I don't want to be too specific, but if you think about it, you'll see that the non-Torah systems in the world always shrink the divine thing to a human thing. And you can work it out for yourself. That's what it boils down to. Because it's a projection of the self. The self is what's important. Man, me, that's what's important. It's incredibly put in the Chazal. The Chazal say that tzaddikim elokeihem oimdim aleihem. Righteous people, their God stands over them. But evil people, aval rishayim, heim oimdim al elokeihem. Evil people stand over their God. In other words, you follow. A righteous man, he stands underneath. His God is over him and tells him what to do. But an evil individual, it's not a man who doesn't have a God. He has a God, but he tells his God what to do. Like it says, v'hinei paroi oimed ala yor. Paro was standing on the river, standing on the Nile River. You know, the Nile was the god of Egypt. They worshipped the Nile. Of course they worshipped the Nile. The Nile was where fertility came from. You follow how it fits the pattern. The Nile was what they needed, so that's what they worshipped. But Pharaoh stood over the Nile because he told his God what to do. We need you, do this and do this and do this. But by Yaakov, when Yaakov had the dream, you remember when he was dreaming and he had the dream of the ladder? It says, Vashem nitzav olav, and Hashem is standing over him. Because the tzaddik doesn't tell Hashem what to do. He says, Hashem, you tell me. What do you want? I do. I like it, I do it. I don't like it, I do it anyway. You follow? That's the difference between Avodah Zarah. It's not the difference between idolatry and the correct worship of Hashem is that in the correct Avodah Hashem, what's real worship of Hashem, he's the boss and whatever he says, I do. The difference. And the definition of what's correct is what he says. The concept of idolatry is I'm what counts. You follow? I'm the boss. Now there's a God in the picture somewhere. I'll construct him the way I need. You follow? It's not that I'm worshipping something that tells me what to do. It's just a projection of me. In the end of the day, you'll see it's exactly fulfilling what I want, what I need. You see this idea very beautifully. It says that Hashem came to all the nations when he came to present the Torah. It's a remarkable thing. Hashem came to present the Torah to the Jewish people. It says Hashem miseir ba. He came from the nation of Asaph. And he came from other nations also. It means he gave us the Torah having been to other nations first. That's what it says in Midrash. It says in Chazal. Hashem gave us the Torah having offered it to the other nations first. That's what it says. So what does the Midrash explain? It says like this. He went to all the nations of the earth and he said to them, do you want my Torah? So the nations answered. This is what it says. The Midrash actually goes through the different nations on earth. I don't want to get personal again. But he went to one nation and he said, listen, do you want the Torah? So that nation said to Hashem, what's in it? What does it say in your... They said, well, look, Hashem, that's very nice. But like, that's our national pastime. You know, that's how we live. That's our way of life over here. So like, you know, we're not interested. Then he went to the next nation, and he said, do you want my Torah? And it mentions which nation. So that nation said to Hashem, what's in your Torah? We're prepared to consider it. What's in your Torah? Hashem said, you're not allowed to commit violence, murder, brutality. He said, well, look, Hashem, you know, that's how we live. We plunder from each other, and, you know, we're violent kind of people. So, no thanks. So then he eventually came to the Jewish people. So he said to the Jewish people, you want my Torah? So the Jewish people said, Naaseh v'nishma. We'll take it, and then we'll ask you what's in it. So the commentaries say, well, what kind of people is that? Some kind of feeble-minded individuals. A man comes, offers you a package. Someone offers you a package. You said, I'll take it and I'll commit myself to it. Offers, I'll ask you what's in it. What's going on? Who makes sense, the non-Jews or us? So the commentaries explain this. When Hashem offers you something, by definition, what he's offering you is right. I mean, you're talking about the source of existence. You're talking about reality over here. If you start to ask questions, the problem with asking, you see, the problem is this. Isn't it unfair, if you think about it, first of all, it doesn't make sense, and secondly, did you ever think about, if you think analytically, it's like this, Hashem comes to one nation, he says, do you want my Torah? They ask him what's in it, and he gives them one answer, immorality. He goes to, and it so happens that that's the nation whose problem is immorality. So how does he answer them? Very unfairly. He shows them the one point in the Torah that they're going to disagree with. Well, that's very unfair. Then he goes to the next nation, he asks them, do you want my Torah? They ask him what's in it, and he picks on the one thing that's their problem. Brutality. So they reject them. That's very unfair. You hear what's going on? The commentaries explain, you've got to understand this. When a person asks Hashem what's in his Torah, what he means is, one second, I'm the boss over here, okay? I'll decide what's right and wrong, what's good for me, okay? You got a Torah for me. You got a system of living for me. First of all, I want to judge what's in it. Now, when you say that, of course what's going to stick in your throat is what's your problem. It doesn't mean Hashem only showed them their problem. He showed them what's in the Torah. But they had no problem with the rest of the Torah. They had a problem with a place that's their problem. Do you follow? So of course that's what got picked out. The next nation had another problem. So of course that was the sticking point for them. Do you follow? The only way to accept Hashem's Torah is to say, Hashem, I'd love to ask you what the Jewish people. The Jewish people got their own opinion 100 times over, much more than other people. Very critical-minded individuals. Would have loved to ask Hashem what's in it and assess it first. But they had the wisdom to understand that if it's coming from Hashem, by definition, it's right. If you ask a question already, what you mean is you're the boss. Can you feel that? And therefore they said, Hashem, we'd love to ask you what's in it, but we can't. You tell us what's in it, we'll accept it. And that's why we merited to get the Torah. In other words, the difference between avodas Hashem, which is Torah, worship of Hashem, which is Torah, is he's the boss and I do what he says. And the difference between idolatry is I'm the boss and I'll make him say what I want him to say. I think the point should be clear by now. There's much, much more to say, but I just want to make two more points. One is about astrology, how this relates, and let's go back to the Mishnah that we began. Another 5 minutes, and then let you go and have some Simchas Bas Hasheva. It says this. First of all, astrology. The concept of astrology is relating to the intermediate level. It's relating to the intermediate. It's exactly what it is. It's relating to what delivers the goods. I'm not interested in what comes, what starts about. Well, I care where it comes from, ultimately. I'm interested in where it flows out into my world. I can read it over there, and I can see the way it's going to be and how it's all stacked up for me, so that's what I want to relate to. What's the problem with it? Why is it forbidden? Why is it osur in Torah? Why is it forbidden to be involved in astrology? For the same reason that idolatry is forbidden. You have to hear well. When you look at the sources, right, let me just say two things. One is it's forbidden, okay? That's why a person shouldn't do. You're not allowed to go to an astrologer. There are many things you're not allowed to do in this spiritualist type of field. Some you are, some you're not. I'm not going to go into that halachas of it now. One thing you may not do is go to an astrologer to ask the astrologer what is predicted for me. You're not allowed to do that. By the way, it says in halacha that if an astrologer walks up to you and tells you what's going to be, you're allowed to believe it. You don't have to believe it's nonsense. You're allowed to believe that it's real and you can take certain steps to prevent the thing. Definitely. We're not discrediting it as invalid. On the contrary, you're allowed to believe that it's real, but you may not seek it. Now, why may you not seek it? For the Torah says so. But what's the reasoning, the mystical reasoning? As follows. Frightening thing. If you look up at the sources, at the channels, at the pipelines that pour out the energy, if you look up there and you see the way the things are, and they really are that way, and by the way, this explains the question that I started out with. What do you mean there are other gods? Of course they are. They're real, they're these forces, these energies. Not only do they exist, but they're actually manifestations of the real God. That's how close they are. Do you follow? What's wrong with idolatry is not that you're worshipping something outside the system or something that's nonsense. On the contrary, you're worshipping something very much part of the system. That is part of the channel through which Hashem is manifesting. You're very close. Except, instead of going to the source, you go somewhere along the path and you stop there. That's all. Do you follow? It's very close. We're talking about people who are very, very, very close. We're talking about atheists. We're talking about people who understand exactly where the power comes from. But they're not prepared to go beyond to the source of where the power. They're prepared to go only as far along the channel to where the place is that gives them what they need, and that's where they stop. But they're correct about that. You follow? That's the danger of it. It's a real energy. Astrology means this. When I go to those channels and I see the way the energy is and the way it's coming down to me, the problem is this. If I'm correct about it, and that's really the way it is going to be, you know what the consequence is? It becomes inevitable. You know that? If a Jew goes to an astrologer and he hears the way it's stacked up, that the energies are like this and like this and like this, and therefore this and this and this is going to happen, and he accepts it, definitely, of course it will happen that way. How can it not happen? He's looking at a system. If you want an analogy, it's like a man saying to you the following thing. My dear sir, your wife is pregnant, okay? The child is going to look like this and like this and like this. Why? Because the genes are like, of course he's correct. Of course the child's going to look, how can you change it? Of course he's correct. Do you follow me? So the person goes to an astrologer. The astrologer says, my dear sir or madam, the forces are like this and like this and like this. Therefore next week, X, Y, Z is going to happen to you. Of course it's going to happen. How can you change it? Of course it's going to happen to you. The trick of being a Jew is that the obligation of a Jew is to ignore that, to go to the source of reality, and then you change it. That's the trick of being Jewish. If you don't try and do that, all you're reading is the inevitable and it becomes inevitable. You're part of the machine. And once you're part of the machine, your benefit is now you know what's going to be. But your incredible unbenefit is you can't change it now. The trick of being Jewish is that you disregard the machine, you go straight to the boss, that's a real chutzpah. That's a real Jewish chutzpah. You don't need to sit in the chair behind the counter. The way a Jew does things, he goes to the head of the department store. Is that right? And he says to him, listen, I want that goods behind the counter, and that's the price I want it for. And you know what happens? He gets it for that price. That's the way a Jew behaves. Do you follow me? In Kedusha, that's the way a Jew behaves. You're not just someone who can deliver the goods. You're interested in the overall thing. You follow me? And then what happens is the channels all redistribute themselves, and they're not the way you saw them before. Actually, it's much deeper than that, because they are the way you saw them before, just that you misread them before. Look, there's no time to keep it too late. That's another discussion, maybe for another time. It turns out in the end that actually it was the way, just you didn't know how to read it. Okay, I'm not going to... If you have time, if you want to ask questions, maybe we can go into that. The point is that, where do we learn it from? We learn it from, it says that when Abraham Avinu, Abraham, began the Jewish people, so Hashem came up to him one day and he said to him, you are going to have a son. So Abraham Avinu said to Hashem, but it says in the stars, I'm not going to have a son. You remember this discussion? He says, I've looked into my astrology. I won't have this son, Yitzhak. I've looked into my astrological prediction and I'm not going to have this son that you're talking about. So it says Hashem took him outside and showed him the stars and showed him he was wrong and told him he's going to have a son anyway. So the commentaries ask, how could he argue with Hashem? Hashem tells him he's going to have a son. God himself appears and tells him he's going to have a son. And he argues. But the concept is this. He wasn't arguing. He was saying, Hashem, you're telling me I'm going to have this son. But the stars say otherwise, and you wrote the stars. Who writes the stars? Who constructs the forces that way? You. So on the one hand, you're telling me I'm going to have this son. On the other hand, you constructed things in this way. So there's a contradiction here. So the commentaries say when Hashem took him outside, he didn't take him outside his tent. He took him outside the world. He took him beyond the astrological system. He took him outside the whole astrological world. And he showed him, you're not inside that world, you're outside of it. The commentaries explain that he merited that because he took himself out the world. He was part of a natural order where people told him that idolatry was the order of the day. And he schlepped himself out of that reality and became a man who transcended nature. So his reward, Hashem related to him, outside of nature. And that's the Jewish ability. The ability of a Jew is that you prepare to put yourself into a transcendent world. Hashem relates to you that way. But only if you put yourself there. If you put yourself into the natural world and you believe that the consequences of the natural order are inevitable for you, you're right, they are. You can't get out of it. You're a cog in the machine and you're subject to all the forces of nature. There's nothing you can do about it. But if you act like you don't belong here, you act with real faith like you belong in another world, what happens is you belong in another world and miracles happen. Miracles happen to you and that's the norm for you. You begin to get the idea. The tragedy of putting yourself into the astrological system is that you're putting yourself into the natural system. It's not mystical, it's natural. It's where the natural forces come from. Once you put yourself in there, you can't change it. The whole point of being Jewish is that you take yourself out of that system and then that becomes the norm for you. You follow, the punishment for astrology is that what it... I'll just give you one example and we'll finish. It says that... Just give you an example, just a tangible example. The Gemara says, if I'm not mistaken, it was the daughter of Rabbi Akiva. The daughter of Rabbi Akiva was destined to die on a wedding day. So it says an astrologer looked at her at one point in her life and said that she was going to die on the day of a wedding. Clear as anything. What happened? She got married. And during the wedding, during the Suda, at the meal, it says she was sitting at the table. She took a pin out of her hair, a hairpin. And she stuck it in the wall behind her. Just, you know, absent-mindedly stuck it in the wall and transfixed a cobra that was about to bite her. Her life was saved. So they came up to her and they said, well, what happened today? You know, what happened special? So she said, no, nothing. So they went through the activities of the day and they found out that a few minutes before that she was sitting at the table and as she was eating her wedding meal on the happiest day of her life, she suddenly realized there were people in the street who were hungry. So she took some of her wedding meal, she slipped out and she gave it to some person who was hungry in the street. Mitzvah saves your life. You follow? In other words, the system was designed that it had to be this and this way. But take yourself out of the system, do something that's superhuman. That's a superhuman thing to do. To break off in the middle of your personal, self-interested happiness and go. An animal doesn't do that. You follow? An animal doesn't do that. Only somebody who's on a higher plane does that. You lift yourself to a higher plane, the whole world turns itself upside down. You follow the idea? Right. Let's get back to the Mishnah and we'll leave it at that. The Mishnah says that our forefathers used to commit idolatry. They stood in this place and they worshipped the sun. But we, our eyes are turned towards Hashem. We're not interested in... Yeah. So Rabbi Yehuda comes along and he says, no, you mustn't say that. You must say, we are to Hashem and our eyes are towards Him. What's the argument? The argument's like this. Our forefathers stood here and they worshipped idolatry. What does idolatry mean? It means that they were interested in who could deliver the goods for us. But we, our eyes are towards Hashem. Not towards idolatrous sources, but towards Hashem. Says Rabbi Yehuda, that's not good enough. Because your eyes are towards Hashem, but for what purpose? You also want to deliver the goods. Except you have, the only difference between you and them is you going to the right source, they going to the wrong source. They going to the channels that deliver the goods. You going straight to the boss, but for your sake, that's not good enough. Do you follow? If you want to grasp the worship of Hashem properly, it's not turning to Him as opposed to turning to idolatrous sources for the same goods. Because the only difference is that you happen to be correct about the source, they're wrong about the source. But the motivation is still you. And therefore the way a Jew should approach it is first you say, Anu Lekah, we are for Hashem. Don't ask what you can get out of it. I'm for Him. And after that you say, my eyes are turned to Him to deliver the goods to me. Do you follow? Of course you want the goods, you human. You want Him to relate to you correctly. That's, you know, you're trying to make a success out of your life. But first and foremost, before you ask for anything, you say, I'm for you. Unconditionally, I'll do it. I'll accept it. I'll commit myself. I'll do it. I'm here for you. After I'm committed, I'm here for you. Now tell me what I can get. And that's what love is. You know, love between a man and a woman. How would a woman feel if the only reason her husband related to her was what he could get from her? That's love. That's a travesty of love. You follow? That's not love. I mean, this day and age, you're lucky to have even that. That's the sad truth. But that's not what love is. Love means that I'm committed to you because I'm committed to you. The first thing is I'm for you, right? My whole being is yours. After that, you say, well, I can get out of the relationship.